This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Solnit's editor. For her essays, which she publishes fairly regularly at my website, tomdispatch.com, I've also edited one of her books, and I think I can say that I've helped her marginally with her work, in return for which she's changed my life, or at least the way I see the world. As those of you who have already read some of her work know, she does have a tendency to do that. She said to me recently, she was being kindly, that I could claim I had discovered her. And I laughed, because in truth and advertising, she discovered me when my site was almost unknown to anyone. And that's not so surprising either, since anyone who has read her books, from her Guide to Getting Lost to her newest work, A Paradise Built in Hell, knows that what she really is an explorer, a mapper of unknown worlds, a discoverer. I don't think she's ever seen a trail she didn't want to wander off, and so it amuses me to be up here, because I'm the person who never saw a trail I wanted to leave. Set me down in the countryside, and it better be on a well-marked trail, or else. Not her. If she plunges into 19th century California, as in her life of photographer Edward Muybridge, River of Shadows, she soon enough finds herself at the origin point of that river, flood actually, of imagery that now makes up our world. If she plunges into disaster, whether the San Francisco earthquake or 9/11, she discovers in the worst of human tragedies the best of human activities and repeated if remarkable moments in which ordinary humans like us exhibit the deepest sort of altruism. She's a kind of wonder herself, as I think you'll discover in a few moments. Let me tell you how we first met, or rather, e-met, since it was online. Soon after the Bush administration's invasion of Iraq began in March 2003, and the anti-war movement, which mounted undoubtedly the largest, most globalized anti-war demonstrations in history, finally packed its bags in despair and went home, overwhelmed by failure, I received an email at Tom Dispatch from Rebecca. She mentioned that she had been reading the site's dispatches and was wondering if I might be interested in putting out a small piece of hers entitled Acts of Hope. I already had a standing no submissions policy. It was a kind of insurance against for sanity rather than an act of unfriendliness in a life without a minute to spare. As it happened, a friend had mentioned to me only a week or two earlier that I shouldn't miss her anti-nuclear book Savage Dreams, and her name had lingered, a faint impression, on my slightly addled brain. As a result, rather than writing apologetically, as I always do, that I don't take submissions, I responded with a genuinely grumpy, verging on unfriendly email, assuring Rebecca that I would probably never get to her piece, that she should certainly look elsewhere, and that above all, she should have no expectations whatsoever, re me. But yes, sooner or later, maybe, I would take a look. Then, perversely, I promptly copied her piece into a document and instantly read it. This, as I subsequently learned, is exactly how the Solnitzian universe works. Strangely and unexpectedly like, as she would say, the weather rather than a game of checkers. She wrote, I quickly discovered, as you will when you listen to her work in a few minutes, like an angel. And the piece was beautiful, offering a wondrous little history of hope in the worst of times, and in essence explaining to all those heading home just why they shouldn't do so, why they shouldn't despair, why they shouldn't imagine that they had had no effect just because you couldn't plot it out on a board like that game of checkers. And so I reached for the phone, called her, and my first exchange with her voicemail was a plea that she ignore my grumpy email and let me publish her piece, which she allowed, and I did. That piece, which offered genuine hope, and perhaps more important, new ways of imagining the hopeful, in a moment dark indeed, later became her small gem of a book, Hope in the Dark, Untold History's Wild Possibilities. And in working with her over these years, her strange and, I think, inspiring form of hopefulness has penetrated my own thinking deeply. She has, you might say, infiltrated my brain, remapped it, and changed in all sorts of subtle ways how I see the world. I think you'll find she'll have the same effect on you. I consider her something of a national treasure. Without more ado, let me turn the evening over to Rebecca Solnit.
Thank you. I can't see a thing out there with these lights on, but I believe you're there. So thank you for coming. This is the only place I leave home to come to that also feels like home. So it's a great pleasure to be here. It's been made, well, I lived here the first few years of my life. I have all these fabulous cousins here and my lovely aunt in the front row. And a lot of people who've made it home for me over the last 20 years that I've been coming here a lot. So thank you. It's great to be here. And also thanks to the Lannan Foundation, I actually own a home in San Francisco, but that's another story. Writing is a kind of endurance sport about how much time you can spend alone over a period of years and decades. And a lot of people drop out along the way for that very reason. I am supposed to be a public intellectual now, whatever that is, but I still spend a lot of my time not just in private, but in the extended solitude in which writing occurs. And like most writers, I was an unusually isolated misfit when I was growing up. The writing comes out of this deeper solitude as well. The curious thing about it is that out of this exile or withdrawal from society come these books, and the books go out like messages in bottles. But I've been at it long enough, this business of throwing bottles into the ocean with all my hopes and dreams and analyses and thoughts inside, that they've had time to wash ashore, and then they've brought people to me. I now have a very rich and wonderful community for which I'm grateful, maybe more grateful because I spent portions of my youth as a hermitess. Out there tonight, I wrote this when I thought I would actually be able to see. Meridel, are you there? Out there tonight, I can see Meridel Rubenstein, in theory, who I met when I curated her work into a show when I was about 25. And Meridel brought me to New Mexico a few years later, where I met my wonderful friend Catherine Harris, now an environmental art professor at UNM. I can, in theory, see Subankar Banerjee, who got in touch with me through Lucy Lepard, who I met through Meridel, and who gave me the stamp of approval when she read the manuscript of my second book and gave me the key to her place in Galisteo as well. On my 40th birthday, I went on a long hike in the morning and contemplated who was coming to the party that evening and realized that though writing is solitary, I'd met almost everyone who mattered to me through my work, and that was a reward I had never understood before. It was after that, on my first extensive book tour, that I realized that the tour wasn't just a job to sell books. It was when I met the booksellers who took care of my books and the readers who read them and keep me in business, that my solitary was the lone block atop a pyramid of people supporting me, the readers and then the booksellers, book buyers, printers, and publishers. And just below, closest to me on that pile, is maybe the editors. Writing is both a deeply solitary and a very collective business, and the editor, if you're lucky, is there to think through meanings and language and form with you, save you from your worst self, and help you find your best and your voice. I've been very lucky in editors over the past 25 years, and nowhere luckier than with Tom, who has the talent for calling forth my best work for his site, and who's become a dear friend who knows what I'm doing when I don't. So keep in mind that what you're seeing in public tonight is a kind of relationship that ordinarily remains private and often unacknowledged, but is critical to a lot of the best books over the last few centuries. In honor of the spirit of this evening, I decided to read a medley of passages that arc from solitude to solidarity. Really, I think I'm reading entirely about love tonight, but not the ordinary loves that we talk about too much, or at least too predictably, the domestic dramas, but about all the other loves that matter. So, and this first section is from my book, A Field Guide to Getting Lost, which is partly set out here. And and actually there's an editor story there as well. I wrote a short book I wasn't sure would ever be published. I had thought I was sick of writing books, and I realized what I was sick of is being under contract and on deadline. I wanted to write a book I didn't necessarily know how to write without knowing whether I would finish it. But I wrote it, I finished it, I gave it to my agent, who gave it to my editor at Viking, my main book publisher, who loved it but said it was too short and I should do more. And the book had a beginning and an end, so it needed some kind of... Who knew? So I looked at it for a while and decided to interpolate. There were sort of five hot chapters, to interpolate these four cool chapters called The Blue of Distance in it. A lot of people think of editors as kind of these censors and bosses who true writers overcome. But often they are doing kind of great stuff. The Blue of Distance chapters are maybe the strongest part of the book. but that's not my job to figure out. Right now, my job is to read you from a bit of the first and the third one. The blue of distance. The world is blue at its edges and in its depths. This blue is the light that got lost. Light at the blue end of the spectrum does not travel the whole distance from the sun to us. It disperses among the molecules of the air. It scatters in water. Water is colorless. Shallow water appears to be the color of whatever lies underneath it. But deep water is full of this scattered light. The purer the water, the deeper the blue. The sky is blue for the same reason, but the blue at the horizon, the blue of land that seems to be dissolving into the sky, is a deeper, dreamier, melancholy blue, the blue at the farthest reaches of the places where you see for miles, the blue of distance. This light that does not touch us, does not travel the whole distance, the light that gets lost, gives us the beauty of the world, so much of which is in the color blue. For many years, I've been moved by the blue at the far edge of what can be seen, that color of horizons, of remote mountain ranges, of anything far away. The color of that distance is the color of an emotion, the color of solitude and of desire, the color of there seen from here, the color of where you are not, and the color of where you can never go. For the blue is not in the place those miles away at the horizon, but an atmospheric distance between you and the mountains. Longing, says the poet Robert Haas, because desire is full of endless distances. Blue is the color of longing for the distances you never arrive in, for the blue world, the lost world. We treat desire as a problem to be solved, address what desire is for, and focus on that something and how to acquire it, rather than on the nature and the sensation of desire, though often is the distance between us and the object of desire, that fills the space in between with the blue of longing, a certain strange deliciousness. I wonder sometimes whether with a slight adjustment of perspective it could be cherished as a sensation on its own terms, since it is inherent to the human condition as blue is to distance. If you can look across that distance without wanting to close it up, if you can own your longing in the same way that you own the beauty of that blue that can never be possessed, for something of this longing will, like the blue of distance, only be relocated, not assuaged, by acquisition and arrival, just as the mountains cease to be blue when you arrive among them, and the blue instead tints the next beyond. Somewhere in this is the mystery of why tragedies are more beautiful than comedies, and why we take a huge pleasure in the sadness of certain songs and stories. Something is always far away. So, and this is from the third section, which is about country music, which I was discovering those 20 years ago when I started driving out here, hanging out with Catherine and Maridel, and making compilation tapes. Blue of Distance was, first of all, a title I gave a compilation tape I made a dozen years ago, and some of the songs were about sadness, some about the sky, some about both. Every once in a while I made a collection like that, mostly to be listened to on loud road trips, and in them I tried to define what it was that moved me in the music that I chose. An earlier one had been called Geography Lessons, Mostly Tragic. And there, too, I tried to get at something about the evocation of place and its emotional resonance in that music. The songs that worked their way into my blood were like short stories compressed into a few stanzas and a refrain. They always spanned and layered time. The music was haunted, was about distant memory, was about the dead and gone, or at the very least aimed at a beloved far beyond earshot. Like writing, the music was solitary, talking to itself in that solitude of composition and contemplation, and the free flow of time that is before, after, between, but somehow never quite the now of a thriving romance. And perhaps this was also the time of my long summer drives, of driving 600, 1,000 miles in a day, of unrolling again and again like movies, like stories, like the stories small children demand for reassurance, the sequences of Highway 40 through Arizona and New Mexico, 80 and 50 through Nevada and Utah, of 58 and 285 through the California desert, of the many secondary highways and other roads, roads whose mesas and diners were always the same, and whose light and wet clouds and weather never were. The protagonists were often anonymous, nameless, described in only the vaguest terms, A man, a woman, a beloved dead a long time ago, a faithless wife, a cruel husband, a hope abandoned, a dream glimpsed once and lost. But the territory in which these dramas played themselves out were evoked in detail over and over again. And if they were tragic songs about the failure of human love, there were also love songs about places whose names were recited like incantations and caresses. The names are just the facts of bridges, mountains, valleys, towns, states, rivers, lots of rivers. Highways were recalled in reverie, and psychic states themselves became places. Lost highway and lonely street. So though they were overtly love songs, in most of them the landscape was a deeper anchor for being and the object of another more enduring love. The grave, the town hall light, the hills and the gallows are all more vivid than the protagonists of Long Black Veil. Perhaps it's that you can't go back in time, but you can return to the scenes of a love, of a crime, of happiness, and of a fatal decision. The places are what remain, are what you can possess, are what is immortal. They become the tangible landscape of memory, the places that made you, and in some ways you too become them. They are what you can possess and what in the end possesses you. The places in which any significant event occurred become embedded with some of that emotion. And so to recover the memory of the place is to recover the emotion, and sometimes to revisit the place uncovers that emotion again. Every love has its landscape. This place, which is always spoken of as though it only counts when you're present, possesses you in its absence, takes on another life as a sense of place, a summoning in the imagination with all the atmospheric effect and association of a powerful emotion. The places inside matter as much as the ones outside. It is though in the way places stay with you and that you long for them, they become deities. A lot of religions have local deities, presiding spirits, genuses of the place. You could imagine that in these songs, Kentucky or the Red River is a spirit to which the singer prays, that they mourn the dream time before banishment, when the singer lived among the gods who were not phantasms, but geography, matter, earth itself. There is a voluptuous pleasure in all that sadness, and I wonder where it comes from, because as we usually construe the world, sadness and pleasure should be far apart. Is it that the joy that comes from other people always risks sadness? Because even when love doesn't fail, mortality enters in. Is it that there is a place where sadness and joy are not distinct, where all emotion lies together, a sort of ocean into which the tributary streams of distinct emotions go, a far way deep inside? Is it that such sadness is only the side effect of art that describes the depths of our lives, and to see that described in all its potential for loneliness and pain is beautiful? All those summer drives, no matter where I was going, to a person, a project, an adventure, or home, alone in the car with my social life all before and behind me, I was suspended in the beautiful solitude of the open road, in a kind of introspection that only outdoor spaces generate, for inside and outside are more intertwined than the usual distinctions allow. The emotion stirred by the landscape is piercing, a joy close to pain when the blue is deepest on the horizon or the clouds are doing those spectacular fleeting things, so much easier to recall than to describe. So that's the first piece of this three-part thing. The second is from my new book, A Paradise Built in Hell. When the 1906 earthquake hit San Francisco, Dorothy Day was 8 years old and living in Oakland, a strange, eclectic child with a longing for God who confused her first intimations of God and the earthquake and its power and its terror. But she was deeply moved by the way people responded to the earthquake. She said long afterwards, while the crisis lasted, people loved one another. She had a life as a leftist, as an anarchist, as a radical, had a relationship with another anarchist, had a child by him, and had a life that was satisfying up to a point. But she missed a deeper sense of meaning in her life, and so she abandoned her anti-religious anarchist to become a Catholic and become a founder of the Catholic Worker. What Tom was talking about, that he loves and hope in the dark, is my sense that changes are not easy to calculate. You don't know what will happen. The changes that came out of the 1906 earthquake, in conventional terms, are not so interesting. But things happen like Dorothy Day, whose Catholic worker activism around the world is still with us. There's hundreds of organizations in the United States carrying on her vision of a kind of horizontal democratic activist engagement with the poor and the needy based on empathy and love and a religious sense of those things. And writing about her gave me an occasion to write about some of these other loves that were so important to the book and so neglected in most of the conversations we have in the world nowadays, the loves that I think were at the core of this book, that was a strange struggle for me to try and figure out what it was about, and that still feels unfinished, but that is, you know, bound between covers anyway. So, mapping the landscape of love. There are other loves, but we have little language for them. In an era whose sense of the human psyche is dominated by entertainment and consumerism and by therapy culture, that amalgamation of ideas drawn from pop psychology and counseling, the personal and private are most often emphasized to the exclusion of almost everything else. Even the scope of the psychological generally leaves out the soul, the creator and the citizen, those aspects of being human that extend into realms beyond private life. Nor will it ordinarily diagnose people as suffering from social alienation, meaningless, or other anomies that arise from something other than familial and erotic life. It more often leads to personal adjustment than social change. Oscar Wilde asked for maps of the world with utopia on them. Were the maps of the human psyche with altruism, idealism, and even ideas on them, the utopian part of the psyche, or just the soul at its most expansive? In his book Arctic Dreams, Barry Lopez writes of whalers in the far north in 1823. They felt exhilaration in the constant light and a sense of satisfaction and worth, which came partly from their arduous work. The sentence stands out for measuring human purpose and pleasure by different standards than the familiar ones. Work gives worth, light gives exhilaration, and the world becomes larger and richer, even for men toiling in cold and dangerous seas far from home. The world is large, and these other loves lead you to its vastness. We're often told of public and political life merely as a force of duty and occasionally a terror, but it's sometimes always a joy. We lack the language for that aspect of our existence, the language that we need to describe what happens during disaster. And yet the experience happens anyway. Again and again, I've seen people slip into this realm and light up with joy. The lack of a language doesn't prevent them from experiencing it, only from grasping and making something of it. During the buildup to the 2003 beginning of the war on Iraq, huge crowds assembled to march in opposition to it on all seven continents. I joined, and although this was about a particular political stance, the expression on people's faces wasn't partisan. The crowd, one march I joined, had 200,000 participants in a city with only four times that many people. On a weekend when people marched and demonstrated on all seven continents of the earth, if you count the scientists in Antarctica who demonstrated. The people radiated ebullience and exhilaration. They seemed to have found something they had long craved, a chance to speak out, to participate, to have voices, and to feel in their numbers a sense of power, to feel that they mattered, that they could step into history and make it rather than merely watch it. It was moving to see this idealistic joy on so many thousands of faces, disconcerting to realize how uncommon this experience seemed to be. This experience, which was essentially that of citizenship itself, of playing a role in public life, of being connected to strangers around you, and thereby to that abstraction we call society. An abstraction, but one that matters desperately, one in which our identities are rooted, in which we act as a community to shape the world, to make the future we hope for, one in which we abdicate and become powerless and are conquered by forces that often seek to destroy us. An even more powerful and pervasive form of this joy came during the election of Barack Obama, which is not a comment on Obama, it's a comment on the movement that put him into power. An even more powerful and pervasive form of it came during the election, when people around the nation and the world wept, suddenly able to feel the pain of centuries as it was in some way lifted, and a hope that seemed out of reach before. The global wave of emotion was about a deep and too often dormant passion for justice, for meaning, for the well-being of others and the fate of nations. We should feel like that regularly, routinely in a democracy, but the experience is rare in too many societies and nations. Some part of this joy is found in disaster, and its effect is so profound that some people remember disasters, from the London Blitz to the collapse of the World Trade Center towers, with strange ardor. We have, most of us, a deep desire for this democratic public life, for a voice, for membership, for purpose and meaning that cannot be only personal, cannot be satisfied by a single figure, by a leader. We want larger selves in a larger world. It is part of the seduction of war William James warned against in his great talk just before the earthquake. William James, who in Stanford in February of 1906 gave his talk, The Moral Equivalent of War, looking at what it was that war gave us that we might find elsewhere. For life during wartime often serves to bring people into the sense of common cause, sacrifice, absorption in something larger, despite all the terrible things it also brings. Many aspects of public life open up room for such emotion, some quietly, as anyone long devoted to a cause or community understands, some dramatically, as those who've lived through the warlike suspension of everyday life in solidarity of a major disaster or upheaval know. The extremes of joy are limited to extreme situations, to great public events and historic moments, yet something of their satisfaction tides over into everyday life when that life is deep and broad. So that's from the book. And we didn't run an excerpt from the book on Tom Dispatch when it came out. I wrote a new essay for it about how 9/11 should be remembered, and that draws on the book, uses a lot of the same material and all the same ideas, but is really framed for that day and for the format of the dispatch, which was such a new thing when Tom did put out Acts of Hope, which was really already called Hope in the Dark, but was being tinkered with by another editor, who's one of the bad editors we won't talk about tonight, but sort of dog in the manger. But I was amazed when we put the piece out. It didn't just go out on Tom Dispatch, but it got picked up, ultimately, I suspect, by hundreds of sites, and I lost track at probably 60 or 70. It got pirated by two alternative newspapers in the United States. It got run in the San Francisco Chronicle. It got printed up by a graphic designer I know as a handout, and eventually turned into a book that's being translated in Cuba right now and is in Korean and Greek. And it had this kind of crazy life. And it was this introduction to a kind of immediacy and ability, both in the temporal and technical aspects of the internet, to reach people immediately and talk about what was going on right now, and a change in my work to write more directly to not politics itself as we think of it, which is about power and money and the things we usually call history, but the emotions behind it, the interior introspective life of what goes on in public. And, you know, and so I changed as a writer, and that really came out of the war. Most of the things that have made me as a writer have been fairly terrible things in a strange way. As in 1988, as a young activist, an anti-nuclear activist, I began going to the Nevada test site. And I would say it was the test site that taught me how to write, because it was a place so rich and so complex, and the forces that came together, the Western Shoshone, the history of physics, the history of civil disobedience from Thoreau on, the history of nuclear weapons, that to describe it, I had to change my writing. And the internet and Tom Dispatch gave me a chance to change it again. And the war gave me a need to speak more directly to the people's hopes and to their despairs and to the moment, which is a big build-up for a piece that might not live up to that. But anyway, we put it out on September 11th, and the LA Times ran it too. 8 years ago, 2,600 people lost their lives in Manhattan, and then several million people lost their story. The Al-Qaeda attacks on the Twin Towers did not defeat New Yorkers. It destroyed the buildings, contaminated the region, killed thousands, and disrupted the global economy, but it most assuredly did not conquer the citizenry. They were only defeated when their resilience was stolen from them by clichés, by the invisibility of what they accomplished that extraordinary morning, and by the very word terrorism, which suggests that they, or we, were all terrified. The distortion, even obliteration, of what actually happened was a necessary precursor to launching the obscene response that culminated in a war on Iraq, a war we lost, even if some of us don't know that yet, and the loss of civil liberties and democratic principles that went with it. For this 8th anniversary of that terrible day, the first post-Bush era anniversary, let's remember what actually happened. When the planes became missiles and the towers became torches and then shards and clouds of dust, many were afraid, but few, if any, panicked, other than the president, who was far away from danger. The military failed to respond promptly, even though the Pentagon itself was attacked, and the only direct resistance that day came from inside Flight 93, which went down in a field in Pennsylvania on its way to Washington. Flight 11 and Flight 175 struck the towers. Hundreds of thousands of people rescued each other and then themselves, evacuating the buildings and the area, helped in the first minutes and then hours by those around them. Both PS-150, an elementary school, and the High School for Leadership and Public Service were successfully evacuated without casualties. In many cases, teachers simply took students home with them. A spontaneously assembled flotilla of boats, ranging from a yacht appropriated by policemen to a historic fireboat, evacuated 300,000 to 500,000 people from Lower Manhattan, a nautical feat on the scale of the British evacuation of an army from Dunkirk in the early days of World War II. The fleet, that is, rescued in a few hours as many people as the British fleet rescued in days, under German fire, admittedly. But then New York's ferry operators and pleasure boat captains were steering into that toxic cloud on a day when nobody knew exactly what was happening, and many thought more violence was to come. Adam Mayblum, who walked down from the 87th floor of the North Tower with some of his co-workers, wrote on the internet immediately afterward, "They failed in terrorizing us. We were calm. If you want to kill us, leave us alone, because we will do it by ourselves. If you want to make us stronger, attack and we unite. This is the ultimate failure of terrorism against the United States." We failed, however, when we let our own government and media do what that small band from the other side of the earth could not. Some of us failed, that is, for there were many kinds of response, and some became more radical, more committed, more educated. Mark Fichtel, the president of the New York Coffee, Sugar, and Cocoa Exchange, who scraped his knees badly that morning of September 11th when he was knocked over in the fleeing crowd, was helped to his feet by what he called a little old lady. He nonetheless had his exchange up and running the next day, and 6 months later quit his job, began studying Islam, and then teaching about it. Rosaria Ada Dolch, who was a principal who evacuated her high school that day, lost her sister in the towers, and it's typical of the language of disaster that she says it was a miracle she didn't think about her sister at all, just not how we usually think of not thinking about somebody close to us who's died, but a miracle because she could focus on her students, all of whom were saved, including the children in wheelchairs. And then later she went to Afghanistan to dedicate a school for disabled children named after her sister. And Tom Engelhardt, of course, was inspired by 9/11 itself and by the lousy, corrupt, cowardly media coverage we were getting from the mainstream to create Tom Dispatch. Hollywood movies and too many government pandemic plans still presume that most of us are cowards and brutes, that we panic, trample each other, rampage, or freeze helplessly in moments of crisis and chaos. Most of us believe this, even though it is a slander against the species, an obliteration of what actually happens, and a crippling blow to our ability to prepare for disasters. Hollywood likes this view because it paves the way for movies starring manly men and hordes of stampeding, screaming extras. Without stupid, helpless people to save, heroes become unnecessary. Or rather, without them, it turns out that we're all heroes, even if distinctly unstereotypical ones, like the elderly woman who got Fichtel back on his feet. Governments like the Grimview for a similar reason. It justifies their existence as repressive, controlling, hostile forces rather than collaborators with brave and powerful citizenries. Far more people could have died on September 11th if New Yorkers had not remained calm, had not helped each other out of the endangered buildings in the devastated area, had not reached out to pull people from the collapsing buildings in the dust cloud. The population of the towers was lower than usual that morning because it was an election day and many were voting before heading to work. It seems emblematic that so many were spared because they're exercising their democratic powers. Others exercised their empathy and altruism. In the evacuation of the towers, John Abruzzo, a paraplegic accountant, was carried down 69 flights of stairs by his co-workers. Here's how John Guilfoy, a young man who'd been a college athlete, recalled the 9/11 moment. He said, in the Columbia Oral History Archive I used, along with my own interviews, published records, conversations, and emails from friends, he said, I remember looking back as I started running, and the thickest smoke was right where it was, you know, a few blocks away, and thinking that, like, whoever's going to be in that is just going to die. There's no way you could. You're going to suffocate, and it was coming at us. I remember just running, people screaming. I was somewhat calm, and I was a little faster than my colleagues, so I had to stop and slow up a little bit and wait for them to make sure we didn't lose each other. Did you hear that? With all that coughing, I'm going to read, and because it's so amazing, I'm going to read the last bit again. You're going to suffocate, and it was coming at us. I remember just running, people screaming. I was somewhat calm, and I was a little bit faster than my colleagues, so I had to stop and slow up a little bit and wait for them to make sure we didn't lose each other. Had he been in a disaster movie, he would have been struggling in some selfish social Darwinist way to survive at others' expense, or he simply would have panicked, as we're all supposed to do in disaster. In the reality of September 11th, in a moment of supreme danger, he slowed down out of solidarity. A young man from Pakistan, Usman Farman, told of how he fell down, and a Hasidic Jewish man stopped, looked at his pendant's Arabic inscription, and then, with a deep Brooklyn accent, he said, Brother, if you don't mind, there is a cloud of glass coming at us. Grab my hand. Let's get the hell out of here. He was the last person I would have thought to help me. If it weren't for him, I probably would have been engulfed in shattered glass and debris. A blind newspaper vendor was walked to safety by two women, and a third escorted her to her home in the Bronx. Hordes of volunteers from the region, and within days the nation, converged on Lower Manhattan, offering to weld, dig, nurse, cook, clean, hear confession, listen, and did all those things for days, for weeks, for months. New Yorkers triumphed on that day 8 years ago. They triumphed in calm and strength, in generosity, in improvisation, in kindness. Nor was this something specific to that time and place. San Franciscans during the great earthquake and fire of 1906, Londoners during the Blitz in World War II, the great majority of New Orleanians after Hurricane Katrina hit. In fact, most people in most disasters in most places have behaved with just this sort of grace and dignity. Imagine what else could have sprung from that morning 8 years ago. Imagine if the collapse of those towers had not been followed by such a blast of stereotypes, lies, distortions, and fear propaganda that served the agenda of the Bush administration while harming the rest of us, Americans, Iraqis, Afghans, and so many others, for people from 90 nations died in the attacks that day, and probably those from many more nations survived at what came to be called Ground Zero. Not long ago, I talked to Roberto Cifuentes, a Chicano performance artist who was then living in New York. Like many New Yorkers, he still marvels at that brief, almost utopian moment of opening in the midst of tragedy, when everybody wanted to talk about meaning, about foreign policy, about history, about life and death and suffering, and did so in public with strangers. It was a moment of passionate engagement with the biggest questions and with one another. On a few occasions, Cifuentes was threatened and nearly attacked. for having approximately the same skin tone as an Arab, but he was also moved by the tremendous opening of that moment, the greatest public dialogue that had begun, and he took part in it with joy, the joy that was palpable 8 years later when we spoke. In years of 5 years of investigation, and in my own occasion, my own encounter with the San Francisco Bay Area's Loma Prieta earthquake 20 years ago last Saturday, I found that disasters are often moments of strange joy. My friend Kate Joyce, then a 19-year-old living in New Mexico, had landed in New York on the very morning of September 11, 2001, and spent the next several days in Union Square, the park-like plaza at 14th Street that became a regular gathering point. She relished the astonishing forum that Union Square became in those days, when we had a more perfect union. She wrote me, "We spoke passionately of the contemporary and historical conflicts, contradictions, and connections affecting our lives. We stayed for hours through the night and into the week, riveted and expressive, in mourning and humbled, and in the ecstasy of a transformative present." Such conversations took place everywhere in the aftermath. We had that more perfect union, and then we let them steal it. After the 9/11 storm struck, the affected civilians in New York were seen as victims. After Katrina, those in New Orleans were portrayed as brutes, a slander against the great majority, and a cover-up of the real villains in Katrina, the murderous policemen, the white vigilantes, and the people at the level of the national government who made decisions based on fear, on callousness, and on cluelessness. In both cities, the majority of affected people were actually neither helpless nor savage. They were something else. They were citizens, if by that word we mean civic engagement rather than legal status. In both places, ordinary people were extraordinarily resourceful, generous, and kind, as were some police officers, firefighters, rescue workers, and a very few politicians. In both cases, the majority of politicians led us astray. All I would have wanted in that September moment, though, was politicians who stayed out of the way, and people were more suspicious of the news and the newsmakers. The media, too, stepped between us and the event, failing us with their stock of clichés about war and heroes, their ready adoption of the delusional notion of a war on terror, their refusal to challenge the administration as a claim that somehow the Saudi-spawned fundamentalist al-Qaeda was linked to the secularist Iraqi government of Saddam Hussein, and that we should fear mythical Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. Rarely did they mention that we had, in fact, been bombing Iraq without cease since 1991. After 9/11, it could have all been different, profoundly different. And if it had, there would have been no children imprisoned without charges or release dates in our gulag in Cuba. There would have been no unmanned drones slaughtering wedding parties in the rural backlands of Afghanistan or the Rocky Desert. There would have been no soldiers returning to the U.S. with two or three limbs missing or their heads and minds grievously damaged. There would have not been a next round of American deaths, 4,334 in Iraq, 786 in Afghanistan to date. There would have been no $1 trillion taken from constructive projects to fatten the corporations of war, no extreme corrosion of the Bill of Rights, no usurpation of powers by the executive branch. Perhaps. It could have all been different. It's too late now, but not too late, never too late, to change how we remember and commemorate this event and that other great landmark of the Bush era, Hurricane Katrina, which brought down the Bush administration in some way. And to remember them correctly is to prepare for the disasters to come, for there will be many disasters. We're already in an era of climate change. We're already in an era of heightened disaster. And to prepare for it, we need to know who we are and who we could be. New Yorkers could gather in Union Square and elsewhere to remember what happened. Really remember. Remember that the heroes weren't necessarily men or in uniform, but were almost everyone everywhere that day in New York. They could open their hearts and minds to discuss mourning, joy, death, violence, power, weakness, truth and lies, as they did that week. They could consider what constitutes safety and security, what else this country could be, and what its foreign and energy policies have to do with these things. They could walk the streets together to demonstrate that New York is still a great city, whose people were not frightened into going into hiding or flight from public and urban life. They could more consciously and ceremoniously do what New Yorkers, perhaps best of all Americans, do every day. Coexist boldly and openly in a great mix of colors, nationalities, classes, and opinions, daring to speak to strangers and to live in public. The dead must be remembered, but the living are the monument, the living who coexist in peace in ordinary times and who save one another in extraordinary times. Civil society triumphed that morning in full glory. Look at it. Remember that this is who we were and can be. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Now, I believe I'm to the left of Tom, but to you, Tom will look to the left.
Yeah, I think
depends
I
on how you look at it.
Yeah, and there's no podium, so we're naked.
hey, that was a naked podium.
and I, as Rebecca said, I've been an editor, amateur and professional, for what, 40 years now, and I do believe in words on paper. So I have at least some of my questions on paper. It's the only thing I trust. I wanted to start with the first image of yours that I fell in love with. It's not the last one, just the first one. It had to do with a crab. And it was from Hope in the Dark, and you wrote, "Causes and effects assume history marches forward, but history is not an army. It is a crab scuttling sideways, a drip of soft water wearing away stone, an earthquake breaking centuries of tension." And I love that crab. Do you want to talk about the crab of history and particularly what it means for us, especially for activists in the world?
Yeah. You know, I'm from something of an activist family. My little brother particularly has been an amazing activist who politicized me when I was really young. And, you know, and when the war broke out in March of 2003, there was this enormous wave of despair all around me by people who had participated in the anti-war movement. And they engaged in this kind of irrational extrapolation form of argument. They said, we didn't stop the war, which was true. Then they said, we had no effect whatsoever, which was extremely not true. For example, the Turkish anti-war movement prevented Turkey from being used as a landing, you know, as a base for the U.S. to attack Iraq from that direction. And we delayed, and I think we changed the shape of the war in some ways. But that's like the simple, tangible stuff you could see at that very moment. And then, so they said that we didn't stop the war. We didn't change anything. We never change anything. We have no power. And I'd heard this sense of powerlessness. And elsewhere in the book, I say that a lot of Americans want instant results guaranteed or your money back, like those things you send away for from the back of the magazines I read the comic books I read as a kid. And instant results guaranteed or your money back is not really what you get from the way history unfolds, that things often have very slow impacts. And I think Henry David Thoreau became most important when Gandhi and Martin Luther King read him, and Thoreau was not around to enjoy that, unfortunately, or at least not in any form we recognize.
Tell about the failure of your demonstrations in Nevada and the Kazakhs.
Yeah, I was getting there,
Tom. I like
Tom.
The Kazakhs. Okay.
See, editors are also prompters.
Yeah, I'm a prompter.
So, and then he'll sort of cut down when the verbiage gets too out of control, I hope. But the great thing for me with that project was bringing together a lot of time as a historian, looking at these long pictures, reading about stuff, and then participating directly and seeing things actually change. I mentioned, actually, when I was doing the reading, being an activist at the Nevada test site in the 1980s and 1990s. An amazing thing happened in 1989, which is that we got joined by the victims of the Soviet test site in Kazakhstan. And the way that it happened is that the Soviet tests had been very dirty. There'd been a lot of contamination. I think this is a subject close to a lot of New Mexicans' hearts because you guys you know, the labs are managed by the university I graduated from, UC Berkeley, and the tests have mostly been in the Nevada desert, but it all began out here with Los Alamos, and Los Alamos and Sandia are still doing some fairly horrific stuff. So this poet, Olzhas Suleymanov, was supposed to go read poetry live on TV, and this was sort of great that there's a country where poets read live on TV because they're such rock stars. But instead, he got up and read a declaration denouncing testing, demanding an end to it, and calling a meeting the next day in the writer's hall, which was like a union hall. And 5,000 people showed up. They formed the Nevada Semi-Palatinsk Anti-Nuclear Movement, named in solidarity with the Nevada activists. And then they proceeded to shut their test site down, and they had been inspired by what we'd done in Nevada. And so the joke was, well, we did shut down a test site, but the wrong one. But
this is the crab of history.
Yeah, but this is the crab of history. And often you get these consequences that, you know, you can't predict, you can't control, that you don't expect, and you generate these equal and opposite reactions. And I strongly believe, and I've actually heard people in the Bush administration say that Hurricane Katrina is when the Bush administration lost its mandate of heaven, its sort of entitlement to rule, its credibility. And so there's, you know, and in some ways it made Barack Obama, for all his, you know, complexity that we may or may not talk about, possible, that things work in very complex and unpredictable ways, and and that people need to know that. And just to give one last, do you want to go on to the next question? If I had said to somebody when the war broke out, I wouldn't have believed it myself, but if I said, hey, you know, it looks like the Bush administration's riding high in the saddle, they're going to run the world for the next 1,000 years, but hey, would you relax if I told you in about 8 years, this non-white community organizer, constitutional law professor, who's actually the son of a Muslim goat herd from Kenya, who's actually sort of a cool dude, is going to be president and everything will be sort of different. And people would have said, are you out of your fucking mind? You know, and like, you know, and just, and I'm, this is not an endorsement of Barack Obama. This is an endorsement of the sheer unlikeliness of history. How likely would that have seemed 5 years, 6 years ago? And the answer is completely inconceivable. And it seemed pretty inconceivable 3 years ago.
And it's a good reason not to pack up your tents and go home. Basically, I mean, that's the thing I feel proudest of at Tom Dispatch, and that I think I learned from you very early on, which is simply that. Not what I've done there, but the fact that 7 or 8 years later, I'm there week in, week out. I don't even think about what the effect is. I just do it, and I thank you for that.
But you have some measure of the effect in that amazing letters you get from all over the world.
I'm
telling them, Tom. I'm not. You already
complimenting you. So let me move on.
See, an editor.
Let me move on to.
He's squelching my footnotes, people.
Let me be positive now and move on to darkness.
Okay.
You know, also in Hope in the Dark, the last mention I'll make of it, you start by quoting Virginia Woolf. The future is, and she wrote this in the middle of World War I in the grimmest of times.
And recovering from a suicidal depression as well.
She wrote, the future is dark, which is, on the whole, the best thing the future can be, I think. And then, just a page or two into your field guide to getting lost, you also write, leave the door open for the unknown, the door into the dark. That's where the most important things come from. In your work, hope and generative powers seem to come from darkness. Do you want to elaborate on that?
You know, there's a literal darkness. When I was a young punk rocker, I was in love with the night, and I still like that. I wanted to redeem darkness, which is used as a negative thing, and a lot of liberals who I was on the radio with would call the book Hope in Dark Times, and dark times are supposed to be bad times. And there's also a racial connotation to darkness as negative that I think is extremely problematic. One of my close friends, her email tag is Martin Luther King saying, you know, hate cannot destroy hate, only love can do that. Darkness cannot drive out darkness, or something like that. And it's kind of like, Martin Luther King, what are you saying? Darkness is this bad thing. And, well, you know. So I really wanted to redeem the idea of darkness, but I also think that, you know, darkness is this. I spend a lot of time in the desert where most of you know, the end of the day can come as a blessing where you're no longer scorching and burning and, you know, it's starting to cool down. And there's this kind of mysteriousness to it that I like, and a lot of my work, I think, is about trying to come to terms with the unknown and unquantifiable. in some way, and that the dark in this sense is the realm in which things aren't quantified. And the despair is about certainty, I discovered. And I spent a lot of time thinking about it to write the book, and then I spent 3 years kind of being the hope girl during the worst part of the Bush era, which was a really weird job in which a lot of leftists got very angry at me. I joke that this was the book in which I snatched the teddy bear of despair from the loving arms of the left. I've used that line before, I'm afraid. The reason people are so attached to despair is that there's a kind of certainty that gives them a kind of authority and confidence. And it's sad that people would rather have confidence than hope, but hope actually demands that you be open and you be uncertain, that you enter the dark. And, and so dark in that sense, I think, is really, in all those senses, I think is really rich for me. And I'm for it. Yes, more darkness now. And especially as I'm being, look. Just a little darkness so I can see there are actually people out there.
You know, I always liked Studs Terkel late in life. Yeah. He wrote his book on death, and then he wrote his book on hope. I always liked the order.
He was Studs Terkel's editor.
In the 19th century, all those guys, those white guys, set off for the whiteness of the Arctic, and so they were all explorers and so on and so forth. I really think of you as a kind of a 21st century explorer, exploring the unknown, the darkness in that sense, the unknown in that sense. And every one of your books, whether it's literally the landscape of the Nevada test site, whether it's your history of walking wanderlust, in every one of them, you are mapping the unknown, I think.
I hope so.
And, Michael Chabon said, he had this little comment, which I liked. He said, he called childhood a branch of cartography. You've also written things like that. Where do you think your urge to map came from? And what do you make of it, that urge to step off the trail that I talked about in introducing you?
When I wrote my book, Wanderlust, my history of walking, early in it I said the history of walking, if you think of fields of expertise as real fields, neat little rectangles with hedges or fences around them, then the history of walking trespasses through many fields in its trajectory, and it was anatomy, gender politics, biology, urbanism, the history of the environmental movement, the history of the romantic movement, and about 8 other things. I didn't go to high school, and I didn't get trained for any special profession except sort of kind of at the journalism school at UC Berkeley as a writer, which is really a job. They taught me how to find out things and how to report on them. And it's kind of how I see the world, that there's this weird way in which people are taught to package things and break them down to stay within the confines of those little fields, and I'm really bad at it. I can't do it when I try. And, even a single sentence of mine will meander through several fields. And sometimes by you get edited into 2 sentences, but that's another story. But, it's what interests me. And I sort of, of course, it's the job of writers to look at, to look at the world in a way it hasn't been looked at before, to look at things that haven't been looked at before. But it's funny, I just sort of think of, I was joking with a friend of mine that I would have conformed in school if I could have. It wasn't that I was heroic and bold and maverick, it's just that, I couldn't fit in even if I tried, so I kind of gave up. And I think it's the same thing that, occasionally wish, we're talking about this today, that I wish that I wrote those kind of bestsellers where you take a really simple topic, you expound on it from 18 directions, you have no uncertainty, doubt, or complications about it, and you tell people this is the single most important thing, this is the waffle iron that changed history, this is the man who knows everything, this is the miracle cure, this is the single political analysis that's so airtight that it has no caveats. And I can't do that. I have to keep complexity and shades of gray and uncertainty and leave the doors open and have a lot of darkness.
Have you thought out the fact that, is it thought out that any number of the titles of your books are actually paradoxes? River of Shadows, Hope in the Dark, your most recent one, A Paradise Built in Hell.
Guide to Getting Lost.
A Field Guide to Getting Lost. Is this something that you meant, or is it just the way you think?
Well, I am a contrarian, because I think the other thing about my position in relationship to both the left and the mainstream is that a lot of people join the left out of, unhappiness at what's happening in the mainstream, which is what we call the mainstream is more and more conservative. But I grew up inside the left and in rebellion against that. As a kind of contrarian, dissatisfied with that vision too, and wanting to see things differently from that. And disagreeing with that. And, you know, a lot of people get to become leftists to rebel against their family, which is really fun and rewarding. And when your family's left, what do you do? You know, I wasn't going to become a Republican. And so, you know, entertaining complexities and doubts and finding nebulous areas and gray zones and unlikelihoods and surprises and epiphanies and contradictions is, you know, it's part of my job description, isn't it?
It is kind of, which
is your job to write.
And speaking of paradoxes, I mean, you consider yourself a political writer. I would consider you a political writer, and yet you really don't write about what most Americans think of as politics, and certainly not electoral politics. I mean, but very seldom. That's not what you mean by political. You want to comment on that?
Well, there's about 11 ways to respond to that. First of all, is to say that, you know, the feminist thing, the personal is political.
Let's make it five.
Try and keep it down to three. And I wish I had paper here because I would, like, outline it, but I may get lost here. This happens. But the sense that the personal is political, that everything we do is political. In an age of politics around food and energy and gasoline and consumption and stuff like that, you know, we know that everything we do is political. When you eat a hamburger, you're endorsing McDonald's and the beef industry. When you eat, you know, when you eat an organic apple from the farmer's market, you're endorsing something else. I bought some yesterday. They're really great. And here. So secondly, I think, is a sense that the policy stuff is covered by people who do a much better job of it than I could ever do. And sometimes I feel like I'm good at pulling back and seeing big pictures and affinities between things that might not be, you know, and meanings that lie between fields and areas that might not be seen otherwise. And thirdly, I think it's just really that also what makes the public policy, the electoral politics, government, et cetera, is all the stuff that doesn't get described. We see the effect but not the cause, and the cause is much more subjective, much more personal hopes, fears, desires, and beliefs that we often ignore, we assume, but don't really look at. The sense in which politics, not in the feminist sense that the politics is personal because it's about who does the dishes, but that it's personal and that it comes out of these really deep, deep beliefs and stories. And I think the deepest level at which a writer can operate is to change the stories. You know, that you can expose the politician who accepted the bribe, and that has a certain amount of value in changing history. If you can change the very story, which is what I tried to do in A Paradise Built in Hell, the very story about who we are in moments of crisis and who we want to be and what might be possible in ordinary times, when you see both the incredible ability of people to cooperate and to respond effectively and bravely and creatively in disaster, and the incredible joy that brings them, because we want to be those people. We want to be connected and communitarian and purposeful. We want all these things, but we're told that we want bigger cars and more toys and more beautiful lipstick and more vacations in Hawaii or something. And, you know, so for me, it's also about going that politics comes out of culture, and that if you can go down to culture at the deep level, which is these stories and beliefs and the feelings they serve or repress, then you're really doing your job. You know, and other people are there to do the other. You know, it's an ecosystem. People have to report on what happened in Congress yesterday, too. But that's not my job, and I'm not very good at it.
You've described in the new book in particular, you've described these kind of little utopian communities when the state disappears in a disaster. These little communities spring up. I mean, they can be actually big communities, linked communities, and they do things that are actually wonderful in terms of human nature. I mean, they're what everybody imagines we should do. But the problem is, when the disaster's over, they do disappear. Either because, and I'm asking you why, either because the state simply takes their place again, or is it that we revert to some other state? I mean, can you imagine those moments being carried out of disasters, or can you imagine us creating, this is seven questions.
To which I only get three answers.
Imagine us creating the equivalents of those states without having to have the disasters.
I think, well, there's a,
Well,
answer anyway.
Seven questions, three answers. Yeah. We'll see. And I think there's a number of answers. I think often something lingers, and Dorothy Day hung on to that vision she had at eight, and it was really played a role in a Catholic Worker. Dorothy Day's been dead for 20 or 30 years, but the Catholic Worker is still with us. It doesn't always die out. Mexico City had a huge earthquake in 1985 in which the government was as corrupt and callous as it was in Katrina or the 1906 earthquake, and civil society rose up. And I think because there's a certain kind of romantic idealism in Latin America we don't have here so much, because people recognized that power and refused to let it go, it lasted and it changed the country. It changed, it's the beginning of the end of one-party rule in Mexico. It changed both electoral politics and grassroots politics around housing. It created the first independent union, a union of seamstresses, many of whom had been killed in the sweatshops, the rest of whom organized. And it really transformed, you know, you can list all these things. These are the kind of accomplishments we call politics. But it also gave people, the thing in the way that we don't call politics, a sense of themselves, of their own power, and of the weakness of the government that the most interesting cultural critics in Mexico consider to be this rebirth that, you know, is still with them. So sometimes it does last. And I think there's a third, maybe there's four answers, but a third thing is that, you know, I love these moments. For me, they're a little bit like carnivals and revolutions, and I don't think I participated in a real revolution, but I've definitely participated in some uprisings and kept very close tabs and talked to people who have been part of the Zapatista uprising or in Germany when the wall fell 20 years ago, later this month, and et cetera, that you have these moments when it's so great to be there with other people and to be deeply connected. Then you have these moments where you want to go home, and you can't sustain that. It's like, you know, it's like a peak experience. You know, your life isn't, and you know, the 60s were wrong. Life isn't supposed to be a continuous peak experience. And the question is, how do you renew that? And I think a lot of cultures have carnivals and festivals. And the Protestant Revolution in Europe destroyed a lot of the Catholic festivals. And part, you know, one of the arguments is that they didn't produce anything. But they did produce something. They produced civil society. They produced a sense of membership, agency, belonging, and the joy that goes with them. And so I think that there are moments that produce those things over and over again. And they exist in my own life. A place like New Orleans is extraordinary because it does have that incredibly rich culture in which Katrina impacted, but which gave them some tools most of us don't have to rebuild our societies. And then the last thing is, the most amazing thing maybe for me about that book was recognizing that, you know, that some of that is with us all the time. And I have a really rich community that when I have crises has provided incredible support, and that now I know, because I've seen that, I know that it's latent there, and but it exists and it matters. I think a lot of that is with us in a lot of ways we don't acknowledge. And again, the story could be changed. There are these wonderful economists I quote in the book who point out that if anybody asked us, we'd say we live in a capitalist society, but are all our interchanges capitalist? Do parents charge their children for being raised? You know, do friends, you know, meter the minutes and send a bill for listening? And, you know, that a huge number of the transactions, the ones that are most valuable and that are most responsible for keeping us alive, you know, are not capitalist. And that you also see an enormous amount of generosity and altruism and volunteerism. And this country is kept alive by all these systems that counter assist, you know, that our official government creates a lot of poverty and homelessness and lack of medical care. And there's a lot of doctors, pro bono lawyers who come forward for the indigent and stuff. You see that this is with us all the time in a lot of ways that doesn't always have the joy and the visible solidarity, but really matters. And I think it's partly about changing the story to describe that it is there and it does matter, and most of us are part of it in some way. And in that, we can find a sense of agency and maybe a sense of hope and a sense of gratitude for these things that have kept us alive.
And since you mentioned hope, I think we should finish up with
my reading was 5 minutes short. We can go a little over if you want.
Well, this will be.
I don't know if you know, but we have a ticking clock looking at us.
No. You'll take your last few minutes answering this question. What I wanted to know is, Rebecca's work deals so powerfully with hope, and did so in those. I think certainly the worst 8 years, politically speaking, I've ever lived through in this country. And there were some other bad years, but they were wowzers. And, you know, so I thought in the last moment, since you've dwelled in a wonderful way on hope in these years. I'd like you to tell me a few of your hopes for the near and far future.
Well, Saturday there's 4,000 actions about climate change, and I forget how many countries Bill McKibben said in his email. I think 153.
That's a lot.
You know, that all these other crises and wars and Republicans and et cetera are nothing compared to the crisis of climate change. And my younger brother, who is one of the key organizers for the shutdown of the Seattle WTO, says that we're at a moment, a catalytic moment like that, the way he sees this movement coming together. And so I'm not sure I'm hopeful yet, but I'm really, really interested in that. And I see, you know, if you go back to where we were 10 years ago, which I'm going to do a Tom Dispatch about for November 30th, and all of you should go online and subscribe to tomdispatch.com.
Thank you.
And because he's too modest to do the shameless plug, but I'm not. But, you know, 10 years ago, as the WTO was convening, the neoliberals thought they had a game plan for global dominance and the end of history, and that was the WTO. And it looked like nothing could stop it, and we were really the mice trying to stop the rhinoceros. And we did stop the rhinoceros. Then the rhinoceros is now lying in a ditch somewhere with its rhinoceros legs in the air. And the free trade area of the Americas that was supposed to do to the whole hemisphere what NAFTA did to the U.S., Mexico, and Canada was actually killed off by the resurgence in Latin America. Latin America makes me incredibly hopeful because 20 years ago it was a country with more death squads and more dictators, more brutality. And now it's the most democratic in that they have kind of hip left of center people in power, but has these incredible grassroots movements from the Zapatistas to the indigenous movements in Bolivia. And that makes me hopeful. But the single thing that has made me most transform the way I think about the world really began for me in the early 90s when I got involved at the Nevada test site with the Western Shoshone and then with the Quincentennial as this moment. Talk about rewriting stories, rewriting the entire history of Columbus's arrival in the hemisphere, of white people following on that, as one not of discovery as an invasion, and of native people not as being discovered or conquered, but as having endured. And the radical difference in the way that kids are taught in school, that national parks and monuments are signed, in public discourse and movies, in those representations is so profound and was so unlikely from how things looked to me in a pretty dark moment of looking at 500 years of genocide on October 12, 1992. It was so surprising and so remarkable and so much about the power of culture to shape politics and eventually to become the way everybody thinks and everybody writes, and that it made me incredibly hopeful. And that's not a finished story. That's one that's still changing. And with these amazing things like, you know, on the one hand, the Arctic is thawing. On the other hand, the Inuit who were told that they had no future and they might as well forget their language and culture and assimilate in the 1970s got a homeland three times the size of Texas in, was it 1998? And,
in Canada, yeah.
Nunavut. And, yeah. You know, that just, it's the sheer unlikeliness of the things I've seen in the last 25 years of my political life make me not hopeful for specific things, but have a sense of the real power of people from the grassroots to change the world, because we've seen it over and over again, and a sense that they don't know what's going to happen because it's always too soon to give up and always too soon to draw conclusions that assume you know what's going to happen.
So you end on the unknown. And I know one thing. In a couple of minutes, Rebecca will be out in the lobby. And one thing that should be known is people should get her book and have any of her books and have her sign. It's well worth it. Thank you very much. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.